Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Henri Bakke, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He's authored and co-authored and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and most recently, European Response to Globalization, Resistance, Adaptation, and Alternatives. He joins us from Turkey. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Bakke.
Thank you.
And next door in Syria, it appears that the Assad regime is getting a second wind in this long civil war that's cost about 100,000 lives and ripped apart the country that was previously a kind of the family farm, if you will, of the Assad family. What's the reaction in Turkey next door since Erdogan has been at the lead in supporting this rebellion that seems to be floundering?
Well, I mean, the Turks are understandably quite upset about the turn of events in Syria. I mean, they never expected that the Assad regime was going to last as long as it did. I think everybody, like the Turks, including the United States and Europeans, were all expecting Assad to fall the same way Mubarak and Ben Ali in Tunisia had done. But Assad and his minority-based regime is really fighting for its life, and it has support from the Iranians and the Russians, and also now from the Shiite organization in Lebanon, Hezbollah. And they have been able to turn the tide in their favor. And this means that this conflict is likely to continue for a while longer, and nobody seems, at least in Turkey, to have a solution. In fact, I was in many meetings today with lots of people, and I've been asking the same question to everybody, and basically I get the same answer. They really don't know, and they're at a loss. And we're, United States is at a loss as well. So it's not, the Turks in that sense are not alone. The question is that the choices available to everybody are choices that nobody wants to take. For example, if I asked the Turks, would you under any circumstances contemplate military action unilaterally or in conjunction with other regional powers, even if it's blessed from outside? And the answer is a categorical no. They do not want to go in there because it's going to be very costly and there's no support among the Turkish public for this. But on the other hand, the Turks are paying a price for it because there's a large exodus of refugees, and the violence on the borders are affecting the Turks. There was a significant car bomb a few months ago in a border town that killed 50 people. Yesterday, stray bullets killed one person and seriously wounded another. So, I mean, it's not cost-free to be a voyeur, if you want, on the Syrian crisis. But on the other hand, nobody seems to have a solution. And the real problem that's emerging now is not just the fact that the Syrian regime is getting the upper hand, but that the opposition is fighting among itself. The fundamentalist Sunni group that emerged, Jabhat al-Nusra, which is an offshoot of al-Qaeda in Iraq, has been fighting not only the Free Syrian Army, which is the group that is backed by the West and by the Turks, but also yesterday, for instance, they've been involved in heavy clashes with the Kurdish groups in northeastern Syria. And so the problem is that the al-Nusra fighters tend to be very battle-hardened fighters, willing to take enormous risks, and tend to be very, very good at what they do, and they're far more effective as a military force than, say, the Free Syrian Army. But they're also willing to kill opponents of the Assad regime because for them it's far more important to have a pure opposition than an opposition that will win. And so they are cannibalizing themselves. And in a way, you have more than one war going on in Syria at the moment. You have one between the opposition and the regime, but you also have many little wars among the opposition. And if you are, let's say, a leader of the Free Syrian Army, you don't know which way to look. Do you look at the Jabhat al-Nusra, or you look at the Assad's regime forces that are making headway? So it is a very, very difficult situation. And of course, the civilians who are caught in between are really the ones who are suffering the most, because even in places where that have been liberated by the Free Syrian Army, now you have clashes, and they get caught between the fundamentalist forces and the Free Syrian Army, and this is going to create a major backlash against the opposition. So. And that's what, in a way, what Assad has been banking on since the beginning. I mean, he wanted probably this to be a fight between him and as much as possible between him and the fundamentalists, because that's a very clear-cut line of division where, in a way, the two sides are more quite odious. And he's getting that fight. Plus, he has now the advantage of having Hezbollah, which is a well-trained force that is very effective on the ground, that can teach the Syrian army and help them organize. So we're looking at a conflict that, barring any major catastrophe or some lucky shot that that helps undo the regime, that will last maybe for 2-3 more years. And so you can imagine what Syria is going to look like 2-3 more years from now. I mean, Assad controls the major towns, with the exception of a couple. They may get them in the next few weeks or months. But the vast bulk of Syria, which is not very well populated, is in the hands of the insurgency. So we may have a stalemate that will continue for a long time, with cities and towns and villages being bombed and changing hands, and the refugee crisis becoming more acute and more established in places like Jordan and Lebanon and Turkey and Iraq. So I don't know where this is going. I mean, nobody seems to have a clue. And it's going to have very serious side effects on both Jordan and Iraq. Both countries are already suffering from this war, and especially the Iraqis, who are seeing a great deal of violence that's coming also from Syria. So it's a desperate situation, and I really have no answer, and I have yet to meet a single person here in Turkey who seemed to have an answer to this crisis.
Today, before the United States Senate, Army General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, in testimony said that he had given President Barack Obama options for the use of force in Syria, and in answers to questions from Senator Lindsey Graham that the Assad forces appear to have the upper hand, Dempsey said currently the tide seems to have shifted in his favor. So apparently the general didn't want to talk about, obviously, in details in public about what the options are, but they're talking apparently about kinetic strikes. And there was a kinetic strike on July the 3rd by Israel in Latakia, where apparently they blew up a bunch of Russian anti-ship missiles that had just arrived. The Israelis apparently are upset with the U.S. where that leak came from. What do you think are the possibilities of, I mean, there's some tremendous lobbying going on in the Senate from a lot of senators, including Lindsey Graham, but also John McCain and Carl Levin, telling the White House that we simply cannot have Iran win this one. Is that what's motivating our side?
Look, I actually don't think Iran is winning anything at the moment. Assad's victory in Iran is a defeat for Iran as much as Assad's defeat in Iran is a defeat for Iran. Iran is the only serious loser other than the Syrian people in this conflict, for the simple reason that what we are seeing in the Middle East now is a radical increase in sectarianism, sectarian violence, divisions between Sunnis and Shia. And when that happens, the Iranians by virtue of being representing the Shia minority, are bound to lose because they are the minority, and they're turning the rest of the region essentially against them, and increased radicalization in the Arab world, sectarian radicalization, does not help the Iranian push their message. On the contrary, the message gets narrower and narrower, and only gets listened to those Arabs who happen to be of the Shia persuasion. So I don't necessarily think that it's a win for Iran. Either way, I think Iran is losing. But the issue for the United States is, and I would argue that it should not be framed on whether or not Iran wins or loses, but whether or not one has to stop essentially this carnage from continuing. But, you know, there's carnage everywhere in the world, unfortunately, and this one is particularly nasty and has taken already 100,000 lives and is going to continue to do so. But is the United States obliged every time something like that happens to intervene? And there is no United Nations mandate because the Russians and the Chinese are blocking it. And we do not want to go into another unilateral military action because we paid a huge price for it. And when people talk about kinetic action, look, it's very easy to think of, you know, I'm not a general, I'm not a soldier, but I can still imagine that just sending a few planes to bomb a few targets will make some people feel good. But it is not necessarily action that will bring an end to this conflict. We have a civil war in which both sides are fighting for their lives now. And American sorties over Syria bombing 5 targets or 55 targets, it will not change necessarily the course of the battle. So that will mean that if we start doing any kinetic action, as people call it, I mean, let's call it for what it is, bombing, and we don't get results in Syria, the pressure is going to increase. The pressure is going to mount on the administration to increase the number of bombings, the number of sorties. We will lose American lives. We will kill civilians. And in the end, this is going to be a morass that we will in the end own, and we'll have to fix it. And under the current circumstances, where we have sequestration, where the government has problems making ends meet, we cannot do this. And the cost is economically very high, but also politically. I mean, the United States is going to get involved in another war, in another war with another Muslim country, and no one is going to end at the end like what the United States does. Either they'll be disappointed or they'll think we've done too much. So, you know, we have to figure out a way where the regional countries take the lead and they come up with a solution that we can back them. I mean, we can do a lot to back a regional solution, but the problem is that, you know, it takes a lot of guts and a lot of forward thinking in terms of coming up with a regional solution, and nobody, from what I can tell, seems to be doing that or wanting to do that, and everybody's sitting and waiting for the United States somehow to come and solve the problem. And I think once they have to understand that the United States should not do it and will not do it, maybe that's going to force them to come up with an alternative solution. I don't know. I mean, the other thing is the Russians. I mean, the Russians also have to understand that they're going to pay a terrible price for the continuing to support Assad. And the trick may be for countries in the region to come up with something that the Russians will buy into. But the problem is, I don't see much thinking going on as far as I can tell, along these lines.
Well, in the broader Middle East, though, there appears to be underway something of a reversal for political Islam with the downfall or the coup, if you want to call it, against the Muslim Brotherhood, which I think was fairly soundly rejected by an enormous number of people. And my sense is that if you could poll the secular people in the Middle East, you might find that they're fed up with political Islam and particularly with radicalism. Hamas seems to be losing support in Gaza. They haven't contributed anything except dividing the Palestinians. Hezbollah has lost a lot of its credibility by getting their boots on the ground helping Assad out in Syria. And then you have pictures of Syrian rebels eating the hearts of dead Assad soldiers, etc., and the disgust with al-Nusra and their behavior, which apparently the people in Syria reject, but at the same time, there's nothing they can do about it. There are a bunch of armed men running around. So I'm just curious to know whether, you know, and this is, of course, the irony that our policy over the last decade or so has been essentially to take down secular leaders like Saddam Hussein and Assad. But do you have any sense that there is a growing disgust or displeasure with political Islam?
Look, it's very hard to generalize. I mean, yes, in Egypt we saw a mass mobilization that was followed by a coup against the Brotherhood. But that may make the Brotherhood more popular down the road. I mean, we have to see, because there is always a tendency in the Middle East to support the person who's weak, irrespective of that person or group's bona fide, so to say. That's one. Number two, the irony, of course, is that Assad was very happy to see Morsi in Egypt get overthrown, because he thinks, at least on a temporary level, he may be right, that the new government will be less inclined to take a hard line on Syria, because Morsi was in the process of really cutting ties with Syria, putting more pressure, and Egypt as a country is very influential in terms of determining our public opinion. It is possible that, you know, the conditions on the ground in Syria will make some people think that maybe Assad should be given an option to stay and devise a way in which Syria gets, one finds, shall we say, a soft landing for Assad that is softer than what people had suggested earlier. But again, we are now in the midst of a real change, both on the ground in Syria and in the strategic picture in the region. So I think it's going to be very early to say anything for sure. We'll have to wait and see. And at this stage, for the United States to take any type of action, like Senators McCain and Lindsey Graham are suggesting, I think is very dangerous. It's a policy without an exit option, and we have to be very careful of not getting involved in endeavors and adventures without an exit strategy. And there is no exit strategy. There is none here.
Well, Henri Barki, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Henri Barki, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000, and he joined us from Turkey. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Claire Goldsmith. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.